This is Yolanda Fulton, and I'm interviewing Maria Salas for the Bracero Oral History Project. Okay, so first, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm going to be asking you some questions in regards to the history of your father, who was a Bracero. First, can I ask you when and where you were born?
I was born August 10th, 1952, in Ventura, California.
And is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up in Oxnard.
In Oxnard. Can you tell me a little bit about your family and a little bit about Oxnard?
Oxnard is highly agricultural. The area of Oxnard I lived in was the Colonia. The Colonia is the area where all the, almost all the Braceros lived. In a sense, it was also segregated. There were very, very few blacks there. And the few that were there were my best buddies. They loved my dad to pieces. I come from a large family of 10 children, and my mom and dad. There were 4 boys, 6 girls, and right now we're missing 3. 3 of them have passed away.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to hear about that. And what are your parents' names?
My daddy was Jose Jimenez Salas, and my mom was Jenny Vargas Salas.
And are they still living today?
No, they're deceased.
Okay.
Daddy died in 2005, and Mommy died in 2003.
Okay. And what did your parents do for a living?
My mom was a housewife until after she had the 8th child. And after that, she went to work in the factories, Oxnard Frozen Food, in fact.
Oh.
And Daddy always worked as a placero.
Okay, and so you said you had a family of 10, right?
Yeah.
How many brothers and sisters?
There were 4 boys, and I have 5 other sisters.
So 4 boys, 6 girls.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing you went to school locally in the Colonia, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I did.
Can you tell me a little bit about?
Yes. Kindergarten through 3rd grade, I went to Buenita School. And that was very segregated. In fact, that and I went to, 3rd through 6th grade was at Ramona, and the only whites you saw there were the instructors, and they were all pretty old. They taught, some of them actually taught my mother when she went to school, so they didn't change over at all, but there were very, very few blacks there. I'd say maybe 2 or 3 families, and that was it, and the rest of us were... Most of us were Spanish-speaking when we first began.
Huh. And did the teachers also speak Spanish, or was there any kind of language barrier?
There was definitely a language barrier. I don't recall my instructor ever saying anything in English. In Spanish, I should say. In fact, I got in trouble because I knew both English and Spanish. She was trying to give me another girl's name. It's kindergarten. First day, not more than 5 minutes after I got there. She said my name was Marion, with an N. And I said, no, that's not my name. I put it down. I took it off very politely. Second time, she says, this is your name. And I said, not my name. I took it off, and I kind of put it on the table, not so gently. And she said, this is your name. And she pinned it on me, and she accidentally poked me. And that, of course, infuriated me. I had a very bad temper as a child. Well, I still do. But I took it off, I ripped it in half, and I said, not my name. My name, M-A-R-I-A, Mary. And so she gave me the Maria one and sat me in the corner.
Oh. Okay. That's terrible.
But she knew that she'd have to watch out for me, though, because
right.
I could not stand still.
Huh. Okay, so what's the highest level of education that you've completed?
Presently, I'm a junior at Channel Islands in Camarillo.
Okay. And so you had mentioned that your schools practiced segregation.
Mm-hmm.
Were you there during the time that they stopped practicing segregation, and how did that all?
No, that changed after.
Afterwards?
Afterwards, yeah.
Hmm. And when you were in school, I mean, did you have to work at all?
No.
No?
No, not at all.
In high school either, or anything?
No. after my mom went to work, I was like the second mom, so I that was my job, raising the kids.
And when did you start working, if at all?
Gosh, I started working actually when I was a junior. No, I was a senior at UCSB. And I was up there at my last trimester, and my daddy had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, my other brothers and sisters, of course, said, we'll stop school, we'll get out, we'll drop out. And Mom and I had a talk, just no way. My younger brother, Jose Jr., was a year younger than I am, and he and I decided we're going to take care of the family. So while Mom took care of the kids and took care of Daddy, my brother and I finished off my daddy's contract. So we were little braceros during that time period. We took his lunch pail. I remember it was a big black lunch pail. My mom would get up at 5 in the morning like she did for Daddy, and she made tacos for us, and she filled, instead of coffee, she gave us hot cocoa, you know, an abuelita. And we would take our lunch pail. The truck would come over and pick us up like they did my daddy. And the men were wonderful. They scooted over to make sure Don Jose's kids were okay. And they were amazed that since we had gone to school that we would be willing to do this. We did it for 6 months. We finished out my daddy's contract.
And didn't you remember what year that was?
Oh, gosh. See, 1977.
And so did they pay you the same... Did they pay you each the same wages that they paid your dad?
Yes.
Did they, or did they combine it? Did they say the two for one?
No, each of us got our paycheck, and it was equivalent to what my daddy would have received as under contract.
I see.
And under the contract that he was in, he would get a little bit more money than, say, your average worker would.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so the 6 months that you worked as a bracero after that, did you go back to work doing anything else to do?
Well, after that, Mom became ill. Her arthritis was so bad. Her hands were really crooked, and she couldn't continue, so I took over her work. She worked at Oxnard Frozen Foods on the band, and since I had education, they, of course, said, oh, no, we can't waste her on the line. They put me in a lab coat, and they had me taking sugar measurements and all the various veggies and fruits that they had, which put me in a bad spot with the women there. They thought, oh, look, she has an education. You know, she thinks she's a little better than us. Since I wasn't married, since I didn't have any children, I wasn't worthwhile to speak to, according to these women. I couldn't take that too much longer, so I asked the boss to put me in the freezer. And he said, no, you're educated. You don't belong in the freezer. No, I belong in the freezer. If my mommy could do that, so can I. So I did that for about 4 months. And then that season stopped, and it was hard work. It was very cold, but then you get used to the cold very quickly. After I was there for about 2 months, then the women felt, oh, she's worthy to speak to.
Hmm.
And at that point, I had no need for them. I would just take one of my books and I'd do some reading.
Oh, that's interesting. So are you currently married?
No.
Do you have any children?
No children.
No children at all?
Well, unless you count my brothers and sisters. My little sister would get so confused. She'd go, Mommy, Mommy. Oh, no. You're married.
So you basically were a mom to your little brothers.
My little brothers and sisters.
And where do you fall in line with?
I'm the eldest.
You're
girl.
The oldest? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And so talking about the bracero program, you know, with your father, your father did tell you about the bracero program?
2 years before he passed away, he really felt like talking.
And how old were you when he told you?
I was about 52 years old.
52. And what did he tell you about his experiences in the program?
Well, I know that as a child, I asked him. I heard people say bracero. I didn't know what that was. And my daddy, ¿qué es bracero? No, what's a bracero? And I go, brazo is an arm. Daddy, you're an arm? And he says, well, kind of, yes. They wanted men with strong arms. So I have strong arms. And I remember, you know, grabbing my daddy's arm and him making a muscles. Daddy, you're a real good bracero. You're very strong. So just out of innocence, I kind of got that idea. And I said, Daddy, all those men that work with you are strong arms to their braceros? He says, sí, mijo, somos braceros.
Hmm.
And that's just about all. I guess he didn't feel that I needed to know more than that as a child. But once I got older and I would see my daddy, you know, come home from the field, a lot of people were embarrassed to know that, that their daddy did that. But I started thinking about what my daddy saw when we were children. The truck would come by and they'd drop off Don Jose, you know, and they'd all, adios Don Jose. And then daddy would see us, and a ton of children would be running to him, daddy, daddy, daddy. And they all saw that we loved our daddy so much, we're so happy to see him, that the looks on their faces were one of, I wish I had a family like that. Mm. You know, where I was always very proud of what my daddy did, because we never went hungry. We always had food on the table. We always had, all the necessities were all met. And we also had quite a bit of his love.
Mm. And so when he first told you about the program, how did it make you feel hearing about it?
I knew that it was hard work. And I didn't know all the details as to, say, the processing center and the recruitment and everything else that he went through. I just know the work that he had to go through, the sacrifices he had to make for us. And it made me even more proud to know my daddy did this for me. He did this for my family. And it wasn't until later that I realized why the braceros had to come. And during our little talk before he died, he said, America calls us. They needed help. And I'm here because they needed help. I am very proud to be part of that. I help America. And even though he wasn't a citizen, he was the first one to stand up when the Pledge of Allegiance was done. He had his hat off his head and his hand over his heart, and he would say the pledge.
And when did your father first decide to join the Bracero program? Did he share that information with you?
Daddy told me he was over the age. He was 25, I think. So he was about 31 years old. And his youngest daughter was already getting married. And so he didn't have that responsibility of taking care of my children or anything else. And he thought, this would be a wonderful opportunity. I want to help. And he was very adamant about it. And he thought this would be a wonderful way. I could send money to the kids and make sure that they're okay. And he thought it would be a wonderful adventure. And so he was in Mexico City. He filled out the paperwork, he said. And then after he filled out the paperwork, he knew he was over the age. So he went to one of his uncles who was a judge. And the judge doctored some of the documents.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had all the paperwork needed. He didn't have to give anyone a mordida in order to get the processing paperwork. And my tío was able to fix everything for him.
Hmm. And where was it that he traveled to enroll in the program?
Well, he was in Mexico City, and I think he went. Oh gosh, I can't remember. It was right in the either was Calexico, near that area,
mm-hmm.
And. He said that he was there for quite some time, a couple of weeks, in fact. And he said that was very rough for him because there were a lot of men there that did not have money. And my daddy had money. But at first I thought, is he going to hide it? Or I thought maybe he was going to say something like that. And he says, there were a lot of people that needed money just to go back. And if I bought something small, and I would share it. And I thought, wow, when you think that there's hundreds of people out there, him sharing something like that was, you know, something special. And he said, some people really needed money, because I'd give them, you know, some paper money, and so they could go back. They couldn't stay. They looked sick. And my dad, I always knew my dad was generous, but when it came to something like that, it amazed me that he could do that without fear of somebody jumping him or stealing his money. He was very cautious, and he had a few friends that he, you know, stuck together with, and they would, somebody would buy something, they'd all share it. And I think that's beautiful, because that's one of the things he taught us.
Mm. Do you remember where he was sent to work as a bracero?
Yes, Oxnard.
Oxnard?
Here. He stayed here all the time.
And you were born and raised here, so...
I was born and raised here.
So you saw him every day when he came home from work, then?
There were times when he had a special contract and he had to go to Bakersfield.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, like, for the summer, and this happened every year, so we did miss him during that time period. And one particular time was very... it wasn't until I was older that I realized how important that was. My daddy applied to become a citizen. He went to classes. I remember this because he was sitting in my tiny little chair in the third grade, and his tiny little legs sticking up and everything, but he sat there answering questions. And I remember with the instructor saying something about Raleigh, and my daddy says, "Raleigh's cigarettes, they make tobacco."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, my daddy answered that. I'm very proud of him. Yeah, it's my daddy, you know. And he answered all the questions. He passed the test. He was ready to be sworn in. But the day that he was going to be sworn in, the truck was waiting outside the house, ready to pick him up, to take him to Bakersfield. And my mom was saying, "Joe, you're going to be a citizen." He says, "It's important." And my daddy says, "I understand the bit. Look at my daughters. Mira mis hijas. School's going to start in September. I want them to have their prettiest dresses." We didn't know what was going on. We were just like, "Oh, we're going to get pretty dresses." So we were really excited about that. But it wasn't until I was older that I realized my daddy sacrificed citizenship for us. Yet he was the most, I guess, citizen-like person I had ever met, most patriotic person I'd met. And when you think about what he did in order for us to get everything that we wanted, that was a major sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And presently, I'm trying my best to work with President Obama to see if I can get this done posthumously. And I'll work as hard as I can. I want my daddy to have it, even though he won't be able to say, "Look, Daddy, you got it." I know this was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know that I can fulfill that promise for him. And I'm going to do it if I can. I will do it. Yeah.
You will do it.
I will do it.
So do you remember how much he received in wages and how much he would bring home to the family?
My daddy, it depended on the season. Sometimes he would bring a very hefty check. For us, hefty was over $200, maybe $300. And at that point, it was like we were all happy because we knew $300 is a lot of money. And this was like on a weekly basis, and usually during the summer. Or I forget which, I think it was during the lettuce. It was hard work, but he also got a lot of money there. I guess it depended on how you picked and how much you picked. And Daddy would very proudly, you know, give my mom the check. Like, "I do," you know, she couldn't believe that. So Daddy and I would go to the corner market, cash a check, and bring food home. And the one thing I always remembered about my daddy is that he would always buy 10 little popsicles, the kind they were in the mm-hmm. ink in cellophane.
Mm-hmm.
And he had 10 of them. He'd count Rosie, Tony, Lupe, and he'd name them. And I got to carry those home. And I got to, you know, give it to the kids and stuff like that. But my daddy was always very proud of being able to give them a little something that they'd like. Or he'd buy us a comic book or a coloring book. Just a little something extra.
Mm-hmm.
And just the look on his face was very special.
So, did he have any family back in Mexico still?
He had his children. his daughter, Cleotilde, who, I can't even remember how many years older she is from me. But, they took it a little harder. If anything, she felt the backlash, because my dad was here.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize this until a year after she died. She refused to have her husband let us know that she had passed away. And her husband wrote me a letter to let me know she had passed away and that she was extremely upset up until the day she died, that I personally stole my dad's love from her. And that if it wasn't for me and for my brothers and sisters, her dad would be back home. And it hurt me to know that she felt that. In fact, before Daddy died, a couple of years, I thought I was going to die in the 80s, so I took him back to Mexico to visit the family, he and his brothers. And she was very cordial. She was very happy to see her dad. But I think he saw the kind of relationship that my daddy and my sister and I had. And I started noticing towards the end of our little vacation that she was a bit more standoffish. Because my daddy spoke English also. Mm-hmm. I'd say, Daddy, how do you say? And then Daddy would say it in Spanish for me, and then I could, you know, say it to my sister because I wanted to speak another language. But it hurt that she felt that way, and I wrote back to my brother-in-law to let him know that the things that she didn't know, that my daddy loved her, loved my brothers, my stepbrothers also, my half-brothers, I should say. And every night, even when I was gone from the house, he would turn to the area where he thinks the child is. He would send him a blessing, and he would blow them a kiss. He did this every night for Clotilde. And he says, Te quiero mucho. I love you, mija. Give her the bendición. Every single night, from the time I remember when I was about maybe 4 years old, until even when I took Daddy back to El Paso, he did that every night. And I thought, my daddy loved her. You know, he didn't need to because, you know, she married well. He would still send money over to them. He sent enough money to help my niece get a microscope. She was going to be a pre-med major. He bought her a microscope.
Oh,
and unfortunately, I think she poisoned their thoughts. Because when they wrote to me, they had the same feelings. And I told them, I was glad that I was able to at least explain to her husband, Ricardo, that they were very well loved. And no, we did not steal his love. He had more love for just about everybody. And I mean, he was mom, he was daddy to all the kids in our block.
Mm-hmm.
They all call him Papa Joe, you know. And that doesn't happen to just anybody. It has to take, it's somebody special.
Right, yeah. So, did he have a lot of contact with his children back in Mexico then? Did he contact them often?
He wrote them about every 2 weeks. And every 2 weeks, and I know this because we would put money in there and I would go to the post office and I would register the
mm-hmm.
letter.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get the card back with her signature on it. So I know she received the money.
Mm-hmm.
But we very rarely got a letter from her. And one time she actually came down to visit, which I was really surprised. And they live in an apartment, very small apartment. The shower was really bizarre looking, looked like it was almost outside. So when she came and she saw her house, the yard and everything else, she said, oh, this is a palace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, gosh, I remember everything being so crowded out there, the parking area. It was pretty rough. But, that was the only time she was really nice to me. And then after she left was when we got some of the bitter letters. We kept some of those away from Dad.
Mm-hmm. And have you talked to other families of braceros?
Just kids I grew up with. Kids I grew up with. And a lot of them were really embarrassed to say, my dad works in that field. Look, he comes dirty, you know, and you know, oh, he's a bracero. You know, and it's like, and I couldn't understand that. I was very proud of my daddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he provides, he loves. And I asked him, does your daddy go places? He said, no. He just goes home and that's it. Sits down, drinks beers, and that's it. Goes out to the bars. My daddy never did that.
Hmm.
He never did that. He had everything he wanted here at the house. And I always considered myself very lucky that I never, you know, said anything about my dad or discussed it with other people, how disgusted I was that he'd come, you know, packed with dirt. In fact, at UCSB, when I first went there, it was about 1973, I was in a Shakespeare class. I was the only Chicana in the whole department.
Mm-hmm.
And these kids were sitting there talking about their trips to Spain and trips to Europe, and someone talked about Hawaii, the one that didn't spend much money. They turned around and looked at me, are you in the right class? I'm in Shakespeare 101, correct? Well, shouldn't you be in Spanish or something?
Wow.
And I said, no, I'm an English major. And they would kind of go talking again, and this and that, and they talked about what their papa did, and this and that. He goes, so Maria, tell us, what does your papa do? This is my daddy. My daddy's in agriculture. And it was like, huh? You know, uh-huh. I want to know about this. All of a sudden, they were really interested. So what does your dad do? And I go, well, let's see. Daddy comes home every night with about maybe 5 pounds of mud in each boot. My daddy's a bracero. And then it was one of, like, the way I said it, I guess, it just kind of like, oop, don't want to miss.
Yeah.
No, my daddy did what he did, you know. I'm very proud of my dad.
Huh. And as far as the living arrangements go, you had mentioned before that you guys had went back to Mexico a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and was that during the time that he was a bracero?
No, that was during the time that he was finally retired.
Okay. And, let's see.
You know, I do recall my dad, after the bracero program finished, was about 1964 or so, that my daddy went back to Mexico to get his green card.
Mm-hmm.
And because I remember my grandfather blessing him, and we had an attorney that would help with paperwork. And I just remember looking at Grandpa, and at first they weren't getting along well, but since he realized he loved the kids and he loved my mom, he became one of his favorite son-in-laws. So he blessed my dad, and my dad took off and told him to be very careful. And I remember Daddy being gone for almost a month. And during this time period, we'd get letters from Daddy. And he was trying to get the paperwork done so he could come back. And he did this several times. He'd get something done, come back, see the attorney, wait a while, and then go back and do what he had to do. During this time period, he had been working with Alan Ladd. And Alan Ladd had this huge ranch, and he met my dad through a friend of his that was working in the fields. Daddy spoke English, and he pretty much told him what to do, so he said, I'll have him come work for me. So I worked with him for a couple of years, and during one of those time periods when he had to go back to Mexico, he says, Joe, I want you to take my card. If anything happens, you have them call me, and I will fix things for you. So my dad went, and he was robbed. And luckily he had that card in his breast pocket. So he called, and he said that next thing they know, Alan Ladd went down to Tijuana, talked to some people, paid some bills off, I guess a little mordidas here and there.
Mm-hmm.
He got my daddy some paperwork, and he brought him back to California.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah, it was really wonderful, and Dad was able to get the paperwork over, and he was able to get everything taken care of so he could be legalized citizen here.
Hmm. That's really interesting.
Hollywood helps.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the only reason I found out about that is that we were watching a movie, and Daddy says, Mira, mija, Alan Ladd, tengo una historia. I have a story. So then he said it, and I go, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. That's, wow.
Yeah, that's
that is heavy duty.
Yeah, that's rare.
Yeah.
Very rare.
Yeah.
And so you were close with your dad then?
Very much.
Yeah. And how about your mom? How were you close with her?
Extremely. Extremely.
And your mom, was she here as a citizen, or did she come?
She was born here.
Okay.
That's why they kept saying, se casó con una gabacha. And I go, gabacha? No, my mom's not a gabacha. And I always thought gabacha was blonde hair, blue eyed.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't until older, oh, she's an American. She was born here. Yeah, she married the Americana, you know. No.
Huh. And so how did, I can tell you have a lot of love for your father. You know, how did you feel about your father while you were growing up?
There was nothing that he could do wrong. He taught us so many lessons about, you know, religion, morals. And he did this through stories. And through example, if there was somebody on the block that was out of work and they needed money, you know, it was nothing for us to, you know, get a basket and take some papa, some harina, and maybe some tortillas that my dad had just made, and we would take it over to them because we know that's what neighbors do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a beautiful thing that my dad taught us because I still do it nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nothing you think of it; you just do it because it has to be done. Yeah, he taught us a lot.
Yeah. And now that he's passed away, is that love grown, or how do you feel now? Is there any different feeling?
No, that love is still there, even more so after knowing
mm-hmm.
what he went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a bracero to feed us and take care of us. It's grown like 1,000 times over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more proud of him than I ever was, and I didn't think I could be any more proud than what I was before.
Hmm. And you had mentioned that he talked to you about 2 years before he passed away.
Yeah.
Were there any other stories that he told you was there anything more about the program, about what he went through?
He said that, while crossing over,
mm-hmm.
that it was hard. Not hard in the sense that they had to wait and everything else. Everybody had to wait, so it's something that happened. But once you were picked, he did tell me about the hens.
Mm-hmm.
He did tell me about being examined. And he said, como si era caballo. They looked at his teeth, they're like, pick up your lips, and looked at his teeth, open side, do this, do that, touch your toes. And I said, why did they do that? To make sure you were strong. He says to me, how they wanted strong men. And I thought, wow. And I thought, that was cruel. And then he said, no, it's nada, mija. Creían que teníamos piojos. Sí, daddy? ¿Por qué? And he goes, nos ponieron un spray. ¿Cómo se dice hoy? El DDT. They sprayed you with DDT, daddy? Go see, mija. And I thought, oh my God. I thought he had lung problems. I thought maybe that had something to do with it. But I didn't think they did that to people. It was a shock.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much a shock. I know that after a while they weren't using the short hose,
mm-hmm.
los cortos, because Daddy had his. Once they stopped using them, Dad kept his,
mm-hmm.
which I now have. And I remember Daddy taking it out every year. Once a year, would take it out. And I think it was September that he'd always do this. He'd take it out, he'd look at it, touch it, see if it was sharp enough. He'd refile it very gently, slow and easy. That's how he always taught me to do it. Then he would oil everything to make sure that it wouldn't, rust. And he would wrap it back in that same sack that he carried his lunch, that he carried his tools, his boots. He wrapped it up and he would put it away in the trunk. And I thought, you know, Mom and I passed on that time, and I thought, let's keep Daddy occupied. Let's make a little garden in the back. And he says, Mina, espera, wait, I want to show you something. So I saw him go to the bedroom. I heard crash, crash, bang, bang. So I went to see what was happening, and some things he had on top of the trunk fell. But he opens up the trunk. He pulls it out. And I thought, oh, Daddy's going to use it. He handed it over to me. I got chills because this is something that I knew was very special. We never touched.
Mm-hmm.
And to have him tell me these stories and then give it to me, I was without words. And even now to this day when I do use it, and I very rarely use it, but I do use it, I always think of my dad. And I sharpen it up, like Daddy says, very gently, very slowly. I oil it up, and I put it back in the same sack until I have to use it later on. But when he told me about what they did, the exams and everything else. And he said he was very embarrassed. He's never had to do anything like that. And I said, I know in gymnasium class we have to do that, you know, get undressed and shower and everything
mm-hmm.
else. He says, but everybody's doing it because you have to, you're sweating. But we were just standing there. We were just trying to find work. And then I thought to myself, I do what I have to do. This is going to get me a job. Andale, aquí estoy encuerao, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he did what he had to do. But
And did he have just one contract and decide to stay? How did the contracts work? Did he go back and forth in order to get his contract?
No, he stayed here. He was with Garden City Camp, and he got to know one of the managers there very well. And eventually, that man became padrino to one of our kids.
Mm-hmm.
So they always kept my daddy there. And a couple of times he actually worked with the men in the office because he found a mistake that one of his compadres was making. He said, no, you don't do that. This is how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So mathematically my dad was doing really well. So he actually did some of the bookkeeping. I remember him bringing it home because I would help him with it. I'd line up the names and he'd add up the hours and do all the math that had to be done. And so he'd stay there. He always had that one contract. And when they had a special one, like the one to go to to Bakersfield, they'd ask him right away, do you want to go? Because it's extra money.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my dad said yes. But when he would take off, I do remember something that would come earlier. They'd bring my mom this, I guess it was like a 100-pound sack of beautiful red, white rose potatoes that my mom loved.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring her a sack of those, or he'd bring like plums that they were working on, that or apricots, whatever they were working on, the men would bring, you know, to him, here, this is for you, this is from Jose. And so we were overjoyed. I mean, this is some fruit that we never saw before, or we couldn't afford to buy. But so for us, it was a special treat. And then, of course, once Daddy got home, it was just one of, nobody would let him move. Mom couldn't even get close to him. The kids were all surrounding him. It was always a joy to see my dad.
Hmm. And so what did you think of the Becerro program when you were a child, when you were a kid?
I knew that at times it took my dad away and I didn't quite understand. I knew my daddy was a Becerro, although I didn't quite understand the whole concept of it. My dad said strong arms. My daddy had real strong arms, so he's a Becerro. I thought all men with strong arms were Beceros. And I remember asking my tío once, are you a Becerro, tío? And no. I'm not a Becerro, mija. I was born here. And that was confusing. And then I asked my daddy, does that mean only Beceros from Mexico are Beceros? And the ones here aren't? And he says, yeah, that's right. And I thought, wow, that's crazy. But then I left it alone because it was time for me to go out and play. But little things like that I didn't quite understand. Once I got a little bit older, like maybe 12 or so, I knew my dad had to go because there was a contract, but I thought it was just a contract. I had no idea that it was part of being a Becerro.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I really went to Channel Islands that I realized what was happening. Everything started fitting into place, the stories Dad would tell us, some of the stuff that he used, the clippers and everything else, and I thought, my gosh, now I know.
Hmm. And so now that you know all of this, what do you think of it now?
Well, if the Becerro program had not happened, well, I remember Professor Alamillo once saying, what is the best thing that happened about the Becerro program? And I go, me, I was born. And it's true. If that had not happened, I don't know if my dad would ever have met my mom here. And I was glad that he was here, because I know my dad came here for a special reason. He wanted to help America.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that someone went out of their way to do something like that. He loved his country, but he also loved our country. And especially after meeting my mom and trying to become a citizen and everything else, it was a very special thing. These men changed the face of history. And it's about time someone really recognized it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be done.
And so what happened with your dad after the program ended?
After the program ended in 64, he tried to get his green card, became a, his residence card here. He still worked in the field. He worked for Oxnard Frozen Foods, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for Garden City Camp. And he kept working for them until the day he finally retired. I think it was the age of 79.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only because when my dad had his uncle fix the papers, when it was time for my daddy to retire, he couldn't because it said he was younger than what he was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it took a lot of work to find the correct paperwork. I was able to get a hold of his marriage certificate, and one of my friends went down there, and they actually located the birth announcement.
Oh.
That there was some kind of a war going on at the time, and they took my daddy to the priest. He baptized the baby, signed it in the book, grabbed the book, and ran because they burned down the church.
Mm-hmm.
So he at least held on to it and put it in a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that same book that they were able to find and get a copy of for my dad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, otherwise
if it wasn't for that, yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been able to retire when he did.
Huh.
But the funny thing, considering how old he was, a lot of men are bent. My daddy, very straight back, walked with a very straight back. And I think I got that from him, because I would try to copy him. And he did say that when they were traveling down the second time, he walked with his left foot pointed out. He had injured his foot. And so here I was trying to walk with my dad, not realizing that he had actually hurt himself. And he would tell us little things about traveling the desert, because he actually walked through there. He said that at one time you could see possessions being thrown away, musical instruments are thrown away. So two of his buddies and he, daddy got the violin, one got the trumpet, the other one got a clarinet, and they were playing throughout the desert trying to get home. And daddy says that's one of the reasons why I took up the violin, because I got the violin, you know. But they had some funny little stories about traveling, although I know now that it was really treacherous. But, gosh, it's amazing. He survived.
Yeah. And so how do you think the program affected your life? Or how do you think it affects your life?
I think it's affecting my life more so now than anything else, especially trying to dig through things and finding out information, reading the books and listening to other braceros talk about their adventures. And it's, my gosh, I wish I had known this information when I was a little girl. I don't know what I would have done with it. I couldn't be any prouder of my dad if I had known. But just knowing now what he did has had a great effect on my heart. I can feel the pressure of the, I guess, guilt of not knowing this and not realizing that he sacrificed a lot to be out here. At first it was an adventure, like he'd said, but then afterwards, because he wanted to get back to us, and we were his little family, he wanted to provide the best for us. And that took so much out of him. And he was a very strong little person. He was maybe 3 inches taller than I was. That's not too tall. But he was a very brave man. It took a lot of courage to do that. It took a lot of courage for all these men to do this. But, wow, I can't even find the words to describe how it's affecting my life, or how much it's affecting my life right now. It's something I'm not going to let go.
Mm-hmm. So what would you think about a new Bracero program, then, knowing everything that you know about the past and how it's affected people? What would you feel about a new one, about a new program?
If they were to start a new one, there's so many things that have to be changed. So many people were cheated out of money. It was all a matter of ka-ching, ka-ching, let's let the big guy make more money. And a lot of these men were robbed, especially with the 10% that was taken away from them. That I don't know how they would go about fixing a contract so that these men would have those safeties in place for health purposes, for disabilities, for, you know, death benefits, whatever, if anything were to happen to them, and not be like some of these men that we would see in class. They had a certificate saying, oh, this is, your husband was killed, and this to collect the body, you don't know where the body is. It would be wonderful if they could find a way of having their family nearby, or be fortunate to have their family here with them like my daddy had. There's a lot to be done.
And so for the 10%, did they take the 10% from your
dad?
They
took the 10% from my dad.
And he never recuperated?
No. And I have no documentation. I remember my dad's Mika card. I know it's buried in one of the 20 boxes that I have in the storage room, and I'm just going to have to try and find something there. I do have something that he was supposed to renew his green card, and he paid for it, but they had not sent it over to my dad. So I know there's something there. There's no way of contacting Garden City Camp, because it no longer exists. Yet I do know they do have in the archives up north. And that is something I'd like to get my fingers on. Because
mm-hmm.
I know not only would it help my dad, it would help many men that are out there.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think needs to be done then for the justice for the explotados that lost their 10%? I mean, is there... Do you have any ideas of what can be done?
The only thing I can think of is what we had discussed before, the three of us, that we go to the archives to get information.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, these companies are no longer accessible, mm-hmm. but the archives have their documentation.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can at least find that they're on the roll list, that they were paid, that in itself would help, because it said that they've worked here.
Mm-hmm.
They were under contract. And if that's the beginning, then that's what we have to do.
Hmm. So since Garden City Camp doesn't exist anymore, do you know what type of work that was done there, or what the living arrangements were for Garden City Camp? Did he ever talk to you about that?
Yeah, a lot of them, well, sometimes Daddy would collect his check out on Cypress Road. There was a camp out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, the name escapes me for the moment. But... there was a camp out there on near Wainimi, and I don't remember the name as soon as we're talking, but Daddy lived there for a while, and he lived there, I believe he said, for 2 years, and then a friend of his told him that there was a lady in Oxnard on A Street that was renting out rooms,
mm-hmm.
and it was really cheap. I think my daddy sent them like $5 a week or something.
Uh-huh.
And they had the room. They shared it with another person. There was a laundry room for them to do their clothes. The lady would make food. All they would have to do was buy the food, and she would make food for them.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they ended up going, you know, visiting people like in the Colonia, which, you know, was crossing the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to meet the families there, and that's how he ended up meeting my mom.
Mm.
But he said that living at the camp was rough. I remember going there a couple of times, and you could smell food. In fact, I remember once smelling steak, because I love brown steak. And I go, Daddy, it's round steak. You know, I wanted some. But they said that they were fed well, not, they were given enough, let's put it that way. They weren't exactly, there wasn't a big variety of food. But if they wanted a variety, they'd have to go buy some. And I think the closest place to that was... somewhere down Saviour's Road,
mm-hmm.
And so they'd have to walk, which is kind of tough, especially after a hard day.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were living at the camp, you had to take some clothes to the laundromat, wash them there, and eventually they did have women go in there and wash clothes. But at that point, my dad was already living on A Street, so
mm-hmm.
he had it pretty good compared to some of the other men.
Mm-hmm. Did he talk anything about the descanso at the camp, like what they did for fun, or what if they did anything for
Daddy
fun?
Daddy said that they would go to the city of Oxnard, even
mm-hmm.
though it was far away, and they would travel by truck, and usually there was something going on in the colonia, some kind of a dance.
Mm-hmm.
There would be people on the truck saying, baile, and in Ignacio or something, and people would go there. And on some Sundays, when there wasn't a dance, they would gather like in the patio in our house,
mm-hmm.
and the men would be there with the guitars, even though some of them couldn't really play. They'd go dun 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 dun. After they got tired of it, they'd be dun 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 dun. But people would sing. They'd have guitars, or they'd have harmonicas, and some people would play the trash cans as drums. But it was kind of neat. Daddy, I remember my mom telling me that it was really nice, because a lot of these men stayed together, and eventually a lot of them ended up being our godfathers.
Aww.
And so they had long-lasting relationships. And it was just, I think there were about maybe 10 or 12 men that I recall. And every once in a while, one of them would come by and see Don Jose and see how he was. Or he'd see us on the street, and, oh, mija, ¿cómo está tu papá?
Mm-hmm.
You know. So some of those were very lasting. I know that the kind of work they did at Garden City was agricultural, just
mm-hmm.
about every kind,
mm-hmm.
from strawberries to lemons to tomatoes, cabbage, celery, just about everything you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was another thing that, as a child, made me very proud, because I knew that what was on your table, my daddy picked, you know, and that gave me a lot of pride. I mean, my daddy is doing good work, even though others would say, you know, but he works in the field. Yeah, he does, and he does a good job of it, you know. That's about all you can recall about Garden City. I remember the men were very, very kind when we'd go down there, or I'd go down to pick up my daddy's check. And as I mentioned before, one of them became the godfather to my brother, and they would come over to our house every so often, so we got to know them pretty well.
So did your father ever share with you the stories about the men with the women of the town?
No, he didn't.
He didn't?
He didn't, because once he left the camp, no, he was totally dedicated to my mom.
And did she say anything? Did she ever talk about anything about
the women? No, she never mentioned that.
No?
No. I think my daddy is... I never saw my dad have the eye for the women and stuff. He thought my mom was the most beautiful woman he ever met. And it wasn't just because, you know, when she died that he would say this. I remember hearing this from the time I was 4 years old.
Mm.
Your mama is very pretty. Very pretty, mama. Muy bonita. Muy bonita. Mm. And she was. She was very pretty. And I thought, yeah, especially when she was pregnant, when Daddy would leave, I'd look at Mommy and I'd go, Mommy, you look so pretty. You're having a baby. How do you know? Because, Mama, your face is so pretty. And that's how I knew. Usually after Daddy left, my mom would be sad, but she'd have this glow.
Mm.
You know, so every once in a while when Dad would come home, all of a sudden, this is your son or this is your daughter. And, but luckily, he didn't miss too many of the births.
Yeah. So, our conversation will be stored in the Smithsonian forever, so that generations after generations of people can learn about this important part of U.S.-Mexican history. Would you like to have some last words before we end our interview?
Yes, I would. I'm very proud to be the daughter of Ibracero. And gather my thoughts here. When I first found out what my dad went through, it broke my heart, especially after seeing the film Harvest. I remember it took me about 20 minutes to compose myself before I was able to ask the director a question, and it still affects me. Like this, because it's one thing to read what happened to these men. It's another thing to see a movie. But to actually know that your father was part of this is something that should never be forgotten. And I'm very grateful to Professor Alamillo teaching me about this and lighting that fire underneath me that's not going to go out. It's something that has to be said, has to be found out about, has to be researched, documented, and passed on. And I'm grateful that my daddy is not going to die. He's going to continue. His life is going to continue going. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for sharing with us.